You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome back to His Darker Materials, the podcast that goes episode by episode through the HBO-BBC adaptation of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. My name is Helen O'Hara, and with me, as always, is my co-host Dave Corkery.
Hi, Helen. Hello, everyone.
Hello, hello. And this episode will be covering Season 3, Episode 2 of His Dark Materials. So we will be having spoilers throughout this podcast for Episode 2 and everything previously through His Dark Materials. We will be avoiding book spoilers for further bits of the story, but those might come up in our interviews, so do be warned. And we have a fantastic lineup of interview guests this season. Yeah, let's get into episode two. Did you enjoy this one?
I did. I think this is a little bit like episode one. It was still just, as you said, moving the chess pieces around, but I think a few things have come to a head. In particular, I think that the sort of main showdown in this episode was Lyra and Mrs. Coulter in the little German island. So all the parties end up there at different times. But yeah, I thought good episode, exciting. There were angels fighting. Where else do you get that on TV?
I mean, Supernatural, but that's finished now. So that's basically it.
Oh yes, yeah. You're a big Supernatural fan, aren't you?
I am, yeah. But yeah, no, I'd agree with it. I think it was a really good episode. Practically everyone ends up on that island at some point. So we should probably, I guess we start with the only person who doesn't, which is Mary Malone, who wasn't in last episode at all.
No.
So they did remind us that she existed, I think, in the sort of recap of everything. And she was referred to, not by name, but when they talk about a new serpent arising. So she has been cast in the role of the serpent by this sort of prophecy. There's this prophecy that Lyra, our heroine, will become a new Eve. And Mary Malone, therefore, as the serpent, is presumably someone who's going to somehow tempt her.
With an apple.
With an apple, or with knowledge, anyway. So that's it's an interesting position to be in, especially for, she's a very nice lady, and she's, I think, an ex-nun. I think we know that already about her. And yet we're being told she's kind of the root of all evil. So it's an intriguing start for the character.
Yeah, it's almost like you can't trust religious scripts and prophecies. We don't really get much of her in this episode. We sort of see her still wandering and trekking through different worlds. Mm-hmm. She's on a similar path to Will, also looking for Lyra. We sort of learn that she's in the same world in this episode that Ogunwe is from, right? The temple is mentioned, and there's these resistance fighters. And I think we get a little bit of satellite landscape shots of this world, and it all seems very mossy, right? And it's like overgrown. Yeah. It's post-apocalyptical, yeah. Almost.
That's exactly right. It looks like you see those, you sometimes see, I don't know, listicles of, you know, amazing abandoned places that you didn't know existed kind of stuff. And it's always, you know, some Russian theme park or something that's been left for 50 yeah. years, or a town that was drowned by a dam. And here's what it looks like now under 100 feet of water, you know, and it kind of, it does have that feel. It does have that sort of abandoned, dilapidated feel, but still these drones patrolling the sky, still people looking for dissidents, essentially. And those two girls, I thought that was a really interesting way of building on what we saw of Ogunwe's world last time. You know, they did reference the fact that the temple is trying to take away people's freedom of choice, that it is essentially severing people from their demons, even though they're not external demons, as we saw before. So his eldest daughter, of course, had been made victim of that procedure. But then to hear these girls talk about, literally, women are not allowed to learn how to read. We're not allowed to do anything in this world. And of course, that's very much based in real human history, because we do a lot of that historically.
Yep.
But I thought that was a really interesting way of explaining why the temple might be bad. You know, I think that they're not taking it on faith that you will just reject all authority. They're explaining, no, this is a bad authority. It is not good.
Yeah, and I like that the, you know, these parallels are very deliberate, aren't they? The Philip Pullman puts in, you know, well, obviously he's making a broader statement about our church and our churches in our world and religions, but they. Every world we encounter, and we're basically told this through exposition, that the authority is influencing, you know, that is their goal. The angel himself says it in this episode, right? He will lead a permanent inquisition into every world and every being until they understand complete obedience. And you know, God or the authority in this instance has its vessels and its administrators of this goal on each world. And yeah, and it tends to be similar sort of victims. And Mrs. It's no different in Mrs. Coulter's world. You know, she was the only woman to be able to rise above that persecution.
Yes, exactly. And even then, she knows she kind of essentially walks a tightrope, that she's always kind of a little bit suspect simply because of that, never mind anything else in her past. And, you know, there's been some stuff in her past that might make a person wary of her. But yeah, I thought
we've all killed a few kids every now and then or taken their souls away, right?
but yeah, I thought that it was just a nice little point to make. And it also just showed again Mary's kind of warmth and niceness and her ability to kind of take in information and think about it and process it. You can see there's something going on there. She's putting pieces together. She's kind of trying to figure things out in this new multiverse that she finds herself in. So, and we also see her, you know, specifically like using the I Ching, like casting the arrow stocks and reading the results and trying to figure out her next move. So there's a nice, like, her journey isn't on screen a lot, as you say, but there is it is being developed. We are being reminded that she is on this journey, that she's learning things, that she's studying things as she goes. And I thought it was a really efficiently done in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, very much so. Dr. Malone in the Multiverse of Madness.
Would watch, yes.
Well, let's check in with Will. So Will, the angel and the polar bear.
Oh, I've heard that one. Yeah, they walk into a bar.
They walk through a door into another world. And they've identified the town where Lyra is. Mm-hmm. And they meet Amma. And Amma at this stage has figured it out. Right? She's like, oh, I don't think this is okay.
Yeah, because she basically saw, you know, Lyra's escape attempt, and so knows that Mrs. Coulter is not quite as kind as she seems. I think she's got that great line of no mother could be so cruel, and Will goes, yeah, this one could. It's not a problem.
A plan hatches, and they it ultimately ends in a few good scenes, I think, with Will. Will has that encounter with Mrs. Coulter first, where again she tries this deception move on him and is very convincing. Offers him a cup of tea, and I'm thinking, like, don't drink that tea.
Don't drink the tea.
But he was smart enough not to do that. But I think Will, again, you know, like we said in the last episode, you know, he's strategizing here. He sees what's up. He knows not to trust her. He's not lulled by, you know, her niceties, and he forms a plan outside of that. So he sneaks in separately as another player enters, right? Father Gomez has also found Lyra and Mrs. Coulter.
Yeah, so he's used his little insect, his bugging device, let's call it, to go out and find, track Lyra and Mrs. Coulter down. There was that really, you know, creepy scene of him basically using I think it was Lyra's dress to kind of tune the insect in and then sort of sending off. Oh, super creepy. But yeah, so it means everybody's basically arriving on this, I think, tiny island almost at the same time. So you've got the Magisterium, airships full of basically crack SWAT troops coming in. You've got Will and Yorick and Balthamos coming in by boat. You've got Mrs. Coulter waiting there with Lyra. You've got even Asriel, when he finds out what's happening via Baruch, you know, setting off in the intention craft for the same spot. So, like, everything's converging on this tiny island in the middle of the German Ocean. I'm assuming that's the Atlantic. I don't know. And
it's the German Ocean. Yeah.
It's the German Ocean, you know, the German Ocean. and it is, like, that does make for quite an exciting feeling confrontation, you know, everybody coming up. And I love how Mrs. Coulter is playing all this. So she said, I think it was last episode, almost near the end of last episode, I thought he'd be here by now, I think is her line. And you're not quite sure, does she mean Asriel? Does she mean Will? Like, who is she talking about?
Yeah, it could be any of them.
It could be any of them. And it seems here that she means Will.
Yeah. I think she's banking on Will to find Lyra, and then she intends to recruit him as an ally, because she has acknowledged the power that he wields, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's his strength, her guile, and Lyra's bravery that she names as their sort of defining characteristics, which is, I think, fair. And I love how he's not taken in by her, I don't think, at any point, but he is slightly fascinated by her. And it's not clear, you know, there might be a little bit of that, you know, he's an adolescent man and she's very beautiful. But I think it's more, she begins to kind of convince him she's a mother and that she cares about Lyra as a mother. And I think that brings up a lot of issues in his own life.
I think here's the question, I guess, for us, and the big question is, you know, is she being genuine about, because I kind of think it's so hard to deal with her, but I think some of what she's saying is true. I think she is deciding now, or has decided, I want to be a mother to Lyra, and she loves her. But I think she is just so inherently broken as a person, and has been broken by the world, and has broken herself and with her relationship to her own soul, that she does not know how to do that. So I think her intentions are, as she says, I think her methods are the problem. But there's manipulation at every step of the way. So she is manipulating Will. I think he is a little somewhat convinced by it, but I think he's playing her as well, clearly, right? Because he's
too wary. Yeah. He's too wary to be taken in.
He is. And he's just telling her what she wants to hear. And I think kind of convinces her a bit, right? You know, he kind of leaves it like, okay, I'm going to leave Lyra with you. She's safe. That's great. Okay, bye. And I think she's relatively convinced by that.
Yeah, she seems genuinely taken aback. It's like, wait, sorry. I'm sorry. You're saying no to me?
I thought he was going to stay. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what?
Player got played.
But I think it is. I think I agree with you. I think she does now have feelings for Lyra, and she wants to keep her safe. I mean, she has that great line about, you know, three times she's been in danger and three times I've saved her. And so there is an element of wanting to keep her safe, but it's almost like she's so bad at loving, because she has no experience or practice at it, that it's almost a kind of possessive love. Like she wants to keep Lyra and she wants to keep her safe, possibly in that order. And she knows that Lyra won't be on board with that plan. So she's totally fine with keeping her in a coma to avoid, do you know what I mean? Rather than attempting to win her over, because she's like, well, she's my daughter. I'm definitely not going to be able to win her over. So that's a non-starter. So I'm just going to keep her unconscious. And I think there's an element of, if she was able to win Will over, maybe then there's a way to wake Lyra up and not have her immediately scarp her.
Yeah, I think it's a good play. You know? But
it's not a bad play. Yeah, it's probably the only play, actually. Who else would Lyra trust?
Well, exactly. But unfortunately, she's been so awful in Will's presence previously that, you know, he doesn't buy it.
Yeah.
So she's left then in the position where Will's left. She doesn't have the protection she sought after, and the Magisterium are on her doorstep, right? So then she takes matters into her demon's hand and bashes herself.
And hits herself over the head with a rock.
As you do. And I thought this was another interesting moment on the beach with Father Gomez. This battle of, and the two of them played this so well, the actors, the battle of the wills here, right? It's a deceptor throwing her cards out there and seeing if he's gonna take the bait. But he's you know, like you said before, he's calm and collected and inquisitive, you know, and he sort of just cocks the eyebrow and you know, doesn't buy it. I'll be taking Lyra now. It's like, nice try.
He's almost convinced. And then he says, basically, I'm going to check the house anyway. And she flinches to block his path.
Yes.
It's a tiny little bit. Yeah. She flinches to block his path. And he's like, you're kidding.
Gotcha.
I got you now. And so that's the moment where, you know, she kind of loses. And I think that's another piece of evidence that it is some kind of real feeling that she has for Lyra. It is something that is stronger than her ability to deceive people.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so that is kind of, I guess, parenthood at that moment.
Yeah, nicely put. Yeah, it's an impulse, isn't it? It's a reaction. It's just like, exactly. like on a primordial level.
Yeah.
But she knocks him out with a stone in the end. There's a lot of knocking knocking around the heads with stones in this episode.
Yeah, I don't know how hard she's hit him at this point. You know, we're not quite clear.
Is he dead? We'll have to find out.
But we will. I mean, their scene together also is, again, he's super chilling. Jamie Ward, as Father Go, so chilling. He's like, the very kindest good. Thing you could have done is just kill her.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
so chilling. Yeah.
Dude.
And I loved, he's so good because he is, you know, I was reminded of Inglourious Basterds, right? And just this like very nice, calm person in a room and just the tension that lies underneath that scene. And you know he's got an army outside as well. And I always find that really fascinating, that melding of military and church, and how terrifying that is, because as it would be in real life, it's a terrifying combination. And just that visual again as well of him sitting on that like helicarrier calmly reading a book with all these troops around him with guns, it's just, you know, it's really striking stuff.
It really is, because it's sort of the capacity for a belief in a system, whether that's religious or political or whatever else, to completely override a more kind of profound fundamental morality, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're so convinced that your system is right, that it makes you, that makes anything you do ultimately right as well.
Justified.
Justifiable, yeah. Even if it's something obviously wrong, like killing or stealing or whatever else. So I felt like that's, it's a brilliant depiction of that in his character. And yeah, it's so chilling.
And you could just do your pre-penance.
And you could just, you know.
So, yeah. You know, it's all good.
It's so sensibly set up.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, interview time again. So Helen got to sit down with actor James McAvoy, who of course plays Lord Asriel. And as always, there are some sort of vaguey book spoilers here. So if you haven't read the books and you want to stay completely fresh, maybe just come back here after you've watched all of the show and enjoy.
Hello, James. How interesting to see Asriel back this season. Kind of going commando a little bit. How was that?
Well, you know, I have to buy me dinner before I tell you the real answer, whether it was truly commando. Yeah, it was good. It was really good. He's gone from that sort of kind of Edwardian inventor, adventurer, sort of British, English, Indiana Jones wannabe kind of figure to a warlord, really, to the soldier. He's always had a little bit of military in him, but he's definitely like embraced that this time. He's been talking up a big game about wanting to bring the fight to the Kingdom of Heaven, to build a republic in their face and bring it to them for such a long time. It's just great to finally actually do that. So when we were kind of coming up with costume and stuff, there was a big push to just put me in what I was in the first season, because it went down rather well, apparently. Like, my knitwear was a thing, but I was quite adamant that he'd look like a soldier. And even if it's a kid, like a family show, and you can't be shooting people all the time, guys got to be walking about with weapons, and like, they've got to be under threat the whole time. They've got to be waiting. They've got to be looking at the sky the whole time, thinking there's something coming. So that feeling of war was important, and he had to look like war.
But how was it to kind of play those family relationships this time? Because I feel like you've got more scenes with both Mrs. Coulter and with Lyra in this season.
Nothing with Lyra, unfortunately.
Of course, just Daphne talking about her. Yeah.
Yeah, Daphne and I don't get to meet. In fact, Lyra almost becomes like the Asriel figure in his life in book three, because everybody's telling him she's coming, Eve, she's going to this and that. Next thing, I think it drives him fucking bonkers. It was great. Look, two things. Getting to play opposite Ruth was fantastic, because she's a top tier actor who, a top tier actor, what does that mean? But she is, you know, she's great at acting. Yeah, she's like one of the best, you know, and so getting the bounce off her was brilliant. Trying to understand why he's so mean about Lyra. He's really mean about Lyra in the books, especially in the third book. It kind of comes out of the blue a little bit in the third book, the way that he's horrible about her. Trying to understand that, really, because it's not really explained as well why he's so, like, all right, he's got bigger things, he's got bigger fish to fry. That's always been his thing. That's why he didn't take on real responsibility as her father. But why is he so, like, hateful towards her in the third book? So trying to figure that out and maybe feeling like it was about a father's jealousy of their own children and being usurped by their vitality and youth. And here he is, he's trying to set himself up as Spartacus and he's going to emancipate all sentient beings, you know what I mean? But actually, he's been overshadowed by his fucking daughter, who he's ignored her entire life. And even worse, this woman, this diabolical harridan of a woman that he's desperately in love with, he can't have her. She doesn't want him, but she wants to be a fucking mum. And you're like, what? You could have the fucking heavens, but you want to be a mum? And I think it drives him bonkers. And, you know, that's really her journey. Ruth's journey throughout the whole three seasons is from, I mean, like, apex predator bad guy to a parent. It was really fun to play somebody who was so resistant to being a father and yet still firmly placing himself anyway in the camp of I'm a good guy. Really, like, really conflicting positions to take in the audience's minds there as well, you know, because you are setting him up as a good guy a lot of the time. But you can't ignore the fact that he's a kid killer. You can't ignore the fact that he's the world's worst father. And you can't ignore the fact that his ego is bigger than Jorik Bjørnason.
I've always wondered, I mean, I think you're, and I say this with love, a nerd, because you've been in adaptations of most of my favorite books, whatever. You once, I think, accepted an Empire Award by noticing that you got it from the CAG, because it was Jamie Bamber who gave it to you. So what, you know, was this one of the dream roles? Is this sort of on the list with Leto Atreides and Mr. Tumnus?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what else is on the list?
Oh, God. Do you know what? I loved the Dresden Files when I was younger. I'm not Harry Dresden, though. I'm definitely not him, because he's got to be like fucking 7 foot two
or
something.
7 foot tall, yeah.
There's tons. I mean, I remember sitting in a pub with my mate Ross when we were still at drama school. And we didn't even get auditioned for Lord of the Rings, but just both of us sitting there bummed, just like gutted that like the best story in the world has been told and we never even got to audition for it because we were still in acting school, you know what I mean? There's loads, man. I love, you know, the Bobbiverse. Like, that stuff's brilliant. I love all that. There's tons, man. There's tons. There's just too much. I can't even think right now, but there is. I mean, I don't stop with sci-fi. I've stopped with fantasy a little bit because it can get a bit too... There's still great fantasy out there, but it can just sometimes get a bit not as character-driven as something like His Dark Materials, do you know what I mean? But then again, I don't really put Pullman and His Dark Materials into the realm of just fantasy. It's more than that, you know? But sci-fi, I haven't really stopped with sci-fi, really. And I don't imagine I will.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Lord Asriel and the Republic that he's set up on a hill. So we get a deeper look at it now in this episode, don't we? In the setup, we meet his council. He's got Queen Ruta is back.
Yep, back.
We've got Ogonwe now. Mm-hmm. We've got the Fairy King. What's his name?
Lord Roke, the Galavespian. Come on.
We see sort of, I think as we said last time, you know, it's a guerrilla warfare military camp aesthetic.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? They haven't gone for the sort of, you know, jungle or even forest setup. Like, they want you to be able to see this. And I think that, again, that fits the man's character. He's not going to be hiding under tree cover from angels.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably an element of it's not going to fool anybody, so why bother? So let's just sit here in the sunlight, provoking the authority with our very presence on top of a hill.
It's arrogance as well, isn't it?
It is arrogance. Yeah, it's absolutely arrogance. It's interesting, like his counsels, because Ogonwe is still very wary of him and is still not quite convinced by this dude. Okay. He's now convinced that other worlds exist. He's come through into a different world. But you know, he's still kind of sounding things out. He has that, those conversations with Rudiscati about, you know, do we really trust this guy? Do we think he's going to last the course? You know, is he going to compromise at the last minute? And she's like, lol, no, he's never compromised in his life. That's definitely not going to happen. But, you know, it's a nice little bit of, it convinces you more that he's a strategist, that he's feeling things out. He's like, okay, I admire the camp. This seems to be set up. This seems legit. But I still want to talk to your commanders and make sure you're legit.
Yeah, exactly. He's definitely bought into the cause, I think. He's not quite bought into the man yet. And I think this is where, you know, they differ as characters, right? Because we meet a Gunway in the last episode. He's willing to walk away from everything Azrael is saying for his daughter. And he's saying, I've got my youngest daughter and I'm sticking by my eldest daughter, even after everything they've done to her. And I can't do this. Whereas we know Azrael does not give two craps about about Lyra and is just still referring to her as an inconvenience, right? She's just somebody who just keeps pesky, just keeps coming up. So I think that's a very fundamental moral difference between these two people. Azrael, like his enemy, is a zealot, and he has no time for, he will sacrifice, you know, a young boy to get Roger, to get what he needs. He'll sacrifice his own blood. And we see in this episode, you know, he's not afraid to commit torture to get what he needs. And there's a real cruelty to him, and mixed with that arrogance, and he's almost enjoying it, isn't he?
Yeah, and you wonder, I kind of wondered rewatching this, like, how much is that sort of, there's an element of that cruelty which is almost like a scientist's amorality. That's a scientist sort of going, well, I think I've figured out how to weaponize dust. Let's find out, shall we? Let's do an experiment. And there's almost like he's watching dispassionately to a degree. But then Silmaria has to call him back to himself and go, okay, that's enough torture now. Mm. So, you know, you wonder, is he letting it go on because he's getting distracted by the process or because he's actively enjoying the pain? And I think there might be a little bit of both. If you're on,
I think so.
I think there's a bit of, yeah. I think there is cruelty there. I also love, and I think, you know, we're beginning to see it a bit this episode, that he is just, there's a fundamentally, like, what do you mean people are talking about Lyra? Hello, I'm here. Why aren't people talking about me? You know,
yeah.
He's like, why does my daughter's name keep coming up? She's irrelevant. So what, you know, I don't understand what's happening here. So it's a really interesting beat for him to play.
He is such an interesting character though, because like when you're watching the show, and it's all laid out and you get the exposition dump and then Azrael says his goal and his intentions. It's so obvious. Well, as for me anyway, I'm like, well, he's the good guy, right? He's fighting for the right cause. He's fighting against oppressive forces that want to control everybody. But he's kind of so awful in so many other ways, in his callous disregard for Lyra, our protagonist, in his... yeah, his sort of his cruelty and his malice, his egotism, his arrogance. That he is such a fascinating character because he's hard to love or back. He's hard to back even when he's got the right cause.
This is it, exactly. I mean, and he openly says, "I killed an innocent boy." You know, he's not kind of holding back here.
But he doesn't say it with an ounce of regret.
No,
it's matter of fact.
It needed to be done, so I did it.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
He acknowledged, I think that saying it acknowledges that it's not a desirable thing, but,
yes,
you know, that's what it is. I love, by the way, that the captive angel, whose name I think is Alarbus, but who I'm calling the Kurgan because he looks exactly like the character from Highlander.
Yes, he does, actually.
He does. He can read so much into, again, the tiniest of responses. When he's talking about the authority and the guy drops his eyes for a second, he's like, got you.
Gotcha. I like that. Yeah. Yeah, because, oh, well, yeah, I guess there are some important exposition nuggets from that torture scene, right? So we learn that the authority is not in control anymore. He has a regent called Enoch, otherwise known as Metatron.
I can't believe you dared say that name. Enoch.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And the whole Metatron thing just is so Transformers for me. It always takes me right out. I did in the book as well. It's just so Transformers adjacent.
Yes.
And I think, like you said, yeah, Lord Azrael clocks this straight away. He's spotted a chip in his enemy's armor, right? You know, the whole thing is a bit of a charade.
I wonder if he'd planned somehow to capture an angel anyway. He'd obviously built the cage, you know. It's like the Avengers building the cage for Hulk in the first movie. But, you know, he built the cage, but I don't know how he planned to get his enemy in there if you know, this guy hadn't literally landed in his lap. And I thought it was really interesting that the Kurgan, or Larbus, you know, kind of tries to sow some doubt in Zephania's mind. So she's the head of his loyal angels. And he kind of tries to, like, set in a bit of doubt there, sow a little bit of distrust between them, which is clever strategy, at least.
Yeah, and we also learn that she, you know, he calls her the betrayer, and that she's been, you know, out of the loop for, what, 1,000 years or something? So I like all these little moments that sort of flesh out the angels a bit and, you know, just hammers home how kind of infinite they are.
Yeah, there's a few moments like that, aren't there? There's Balthamus talking about how he and Baruch have been together for, I think, 400 years.
Yes.
There's Rudiscadi talking, comparing, you know, the lifetime of her to a human is like the lifetime of angels to her. It's a sort of order of magnitude greater. And then there is, yeah, that great conversation between Zephania and the Kurgan, you know, about the kingdom as we know it has already gone. This is our final rebellion. It's like, this pretty metal. Yes.
Good lines in it. Yeah. I also thought the heartbreak of Balthamus experience, it was really sad and beautifully played.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, and again, I think that, you know, you need to have that. You need to have that feeling that there are stakes to all this, that it matters to people, that individuals are still a part of these kind of magic, massive causes, that there's still like a kind of a angelic but human level price to be paid, that you might lose your loved one, which feels like a more human concept than a maybe angelic one.
Angels got feelings too, it
seems. Angels got feelings too, you know, it's not easy for them.
I like that the cage was lined with adamantine.
Yeah, well, I felt like McAvoy was pronouncing that very carefully, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So it wouldn't sound too Professor X. So good. But also the fact that, you know, despite torture, despite imprisonment, that this captive angel is still basically threatening, as you said earlier, the permanent inquisition across all worlds. Like, we're fed up of this whole free will and consciousness nonsense. We're just going to clamp down on all of that. Yeah. That's a pretty sinister, you know, thing for your bad guys to be promising.
It was a good line. It's awful stuff.
But, you know, still, after all of that, after, you know, interrogation and torture and all of his planning and all of his power and all of his army building, Lord Asriel is the one who arrives late to the party. You know, everyone else is gone. So you have Lyra finally being woken up, being finally freed from Mrs. Coulter's clutches, and escaping with Will, and initially Amma as well, but obviously she just goes home and hopefully will live happily ever after. You have Will killing again, which we didn't talk about. Will has to shoot a guy to get them out of there, and you can see him instantly, like, freeze up, panic, and drop the gun. So
yeah, he's still not comfortable with it.
Still not comfortable, and still seems kind of haunted by his own capacity for violence. Very, very unhappy with being told there's a warrior in him, you know. So it's an interesting kind of character moment there. So you have Mrs. Coulter unconscious, you have Father Gomez at least unconscious, and Asriel turns up and it's basically like, oh, well, the knife's gone, Lyra's gone.
He's totally unfazed by it all, isn't he? He's just like, oh, well.
Oh, well, so it goes.
Oh, well, I didn't care anyway. Right, back to the mission.
Back to the mission. Yeah, yeah. And we will be back to the mission next time for episode 3.
Yes, see you soon.
Is Darker Materials is a Stripped Media production. Our producer and editor is Maddie Searle. All our music was composed by John Dix. Our artwork was created by Sam Gilby. Our executive producers are Kobe Amanaka and Tom Wally. Our hosts are Helen O'Hara and myself, Dave Corkery. A big thank you to Ian Johnson at IJPR, to Bad Wolf at the BBC, and to all our guests for taking the time to chat to us. If you want to chat to us, you can do it at producers@stripped.media.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.